Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 648, titled Arthur Who? This has been recorded on September 7th of the year 2008. Well, again, as I said in Side 1, we are in a presidential election year, and as always, a serious student of American political science should never lose sight of the role of skullduggery in America's electoral process. In Side 1, we were taking a look at the many grotesque evidentiary anomalies in the shooting of George Wallace, supposedly done by Arthur Bremer, whose release from prison we discussed at the beginning of Side 1. Actually, the evidence suggests very strongly that Arthur Bremer was a patsy and that some other party or parties unknown actually pulled the trigger on George Wallace, thereby eliminating the possibility that he might have run as a third-party candidate and threatened Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, his electoral strategy of sweeping the Deep South on the racist vote, thereby guaranteeing him a victory in the 1972 election. In Side 1, we excerpted Miscellaneous Archive Show M22 about the shooting of George Wallace. That was recorded on July 31st of 1988. We dipped back 20 years into the archives. And what we're going to do on Side 2 is to dip back a full quarter of a century, or almost a quarter of a century. We're going to go back now to The Guns of November, Part 4. Talking about the Nazi connections to the assassination of President Kennedy and also some of the evidentiary tributaries linking our various political assassinations. This program was recorded on November 22nd of 1983, the 20th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. And again, in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Keep in mind the hypothesis that what we're looking at with all of our assassinations may be analogous to what went on in Nazi Germany. And keep in mind the whole nation-building thesis that Fletcher Prouty presents in his book, The Secret Team. Now, one of the things that has piqued the curiosity of a lot of investigators have been the numerous what researchers refer to as evidentiary tributaries that run among the various assassinations. Now, not only are the assassinations and the attempted assassinations portrayed as the work of lone nuts, but they are the official version maintains that there is no connection whatsoever. You know, just a bunch of screwballs going around pulling triggers with no rhyme nor reason to the whole thing. Well, upon examination of each of the individual cases, it becomes clear very quickly that there are a lot of connecting links and similar elements and certain threads running through all of the assassinations. And we're going to cover a few of those for you. Some of the connecting links between the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the shooting of George Wallace, and the assassination of Martin Luther King. Okay, now, one of the, I'm going to go back and read a little bit more from the book that Nip was just reading to you from. It's called The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, published in hardcover by Random House, copyrighted 1978, co-authored by William W. Turner, former FBI agent, and John G. Christian. Christian is just as in Christian. Christian, by the way, was a former TV newsman, I believe, with KGO here in the Bay Area. I'm not sure exactly which station. I believe it was KGO. Now, jumping back again, recall that in Jim Garrison's investigation of the Kennedy assassination, although he indicted Clay Shaw and although the jury found that there had definitely been a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy, they were unable to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw was guilty. And you recall that one of the reasons we mentioned that Jim Garrison was unable to achieve a conviction of Clay Shaw was the fact that three key figures whom he attempted to have extradited in connection with his investigation were not actually, three of the main ones were not extradited. First of all, there was an anti-Castro Cuban named Sergio Arcacha Smith, who had fled to was in Texas at the time. Garrison attempted to have him extradited from Texas. Then Texas Governor John Connally, who was in the motorcade, wounded along with Kennedy, helped plan the motorcade, and who was Secretary of the Navy, downgraded Lee Harvey Oswald's discharge to dishonorable ex post facto. He refused, John Connally, that is, refused to extradite Sergio Arcacha Smith to New Orleans. Now, a second fellow who we talked about in connection with as a possible eraser of the Watergate tapes last week was a fellow by the name of Gordon Novell, last name N-O-V-E-L. He fled to Ohio, and then Governor of Ohio John Rhodes agreed to extradite Novell to New Orleans under the condition that Garrison would agree not to question him about the JFK assassination. Well, of course, that was why, to question him about the JFK assassination was why Garrison attempted to have Novell extradited, okay? Now, the third of these individuals that Garrison wanted to have extradited was a man named Edgar Eugene Bradley, last name B-R-A-D-L-E-Y. Now, Bradley was affiliated with the ACCC, the American Council of Christian Churches, headed by right-wing evangelist Carl McIntyre. Recall, that's identified in Nomenclature of an Assassination Cabal as a U.S. intelligence front, and also identified as early as 1942 of sponsoring Nazi activities in the United States. Now, Edgar Eugene Bradley was stopped by Dallas policeman Roger Craig. Roger Craig stopped a person who he said looked like Oswald coming out of the back of the Texas school book depository. Up came a man identifying himself as a Secret Service agent who later turned out not to be a Secret Service agent, and he obtained the release of this particular man. Now, Roger Craig later, from photographs, identified the bogus Secret Service agent as Edgar Eugene Bradley. Now, Jim Garrison attempted to have Bradley extradited. Then Deputy State Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien, who you heard Nip refer to in the section of the Robert Kennedy book that he read, he reviewed Garrison's extradition request, recommended that it be granted. Now, the day-to-day handling of the Edgar Eugene Bradley request was maintained by Edwin Meese, then legal counselor to Governor Reagan, now, of course, presidential special White House advisor. And He handled the supervision of the day-to-day goings-on vis-a-vis Edgar Eugene Bradley. Then Governor of California Ronald Reagan delayed any action upon the Bradley extradition request until after Richard Nixon was elected president, and then turned it down without comment. And that is one of the main reasons why Garrison was unable to achieve a conviction, okay? Now, keep in mind Jerry Owen, the person who appears to have been driving around Saran and may have been driving in a getaway car at the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Now, the Davis you're going to hear referred to here is George T. Davis, a San Francisco attorney. Interestingly enough, Bradley, this fellow, again, we're supposedly we're dealing with lone nuts here with no connection. Bradley is connected with Jerry Owen here. Reading from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. After Davis left the room to make some phone calls, Owen raised the question of John Kennedy's assassination. Obviously, Davis had briefed him on Turner's participation in the Jim Garrison investigation. As Turner spread a number of photographs from his attaché case on the table, Owen looked them over. His finger came to rest on one of Edgar Eugene Bradley of North Hollywood, who 6 months before had been indicted by a New Orleans grand jury for conspiracy in the JFK assassination. The charges were later dismissed. Bradley was the West Coast representative of Dr. Carl McIntyre, the fundamentalist minister who founded the American Council of Christian Churches in opposition to the modernist, quote-unquote, National Council of Christian Churches. "Do you know Bradley?" Turner asked. "Yes," said Owen. He explained that he had casually met him a couple of times in Los Angeles, the last in 1964. "I was affiliated with McIntyre's church in the late 50s, Owen said, "but got out because these people were too radical for me." So again, this supposedly random group of individuals appears to be perhaps not so random. Now, keep in mind the name of Edgar Eugene Bradley here. Now, recall that Lee Harvey Oswald, in an interview with two CIA-connected individuals called Carlos Bringier of the DRE that we talked about last time, and a guy named Jim Butler of the Information Council for the Americas, who Nip's going to tell you about in a second, basically a very convincing, certainly thoroughgoing attempt was made to maintain Oswald was a communist, okay? A similar attempt at sort of painting Saran red followed the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And the key organization, one of the organizations to keep in mind with a press conference attempting to paint Saran red is an organization called American United. Now, American United was put together by two reactionaries called John Steinbacher, last name S-T-E-I-N-B-A-C-H-E-R, and a guy named Anthony J. Hilder, H-I-L-D-E-R. And their press conference following the assassination of Robert Kennedy, an attempt to sort of portray Saran Red, are touched on briefly by Turner and Christian as follows. American United was the two-man show of John Steinbacher, a John Birch Society propagandist and part-time reporter for the Anaheim Bulletin in Orange County, and Anthony J. Hilder, a firebrand activist. Both were proteges of the well-known anti-Semite Myron J. Fagan, a leader of the Hollywood blacklisting clique during the McCarthy era. In fact, Hilder and a gaggle of followers had been at the Ambassador Hotel the previous night trying to race bait RFK by handing out buttons and pamphlets depicting him and black Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr. of New York on the same ticket. After the shooting, the Hilder group created considerable confusion by alleging that the assailant was a Eugene McCarthy supporter. Steinbacher and Hilder had prepared a press kit crammed with their prolific output of ultra-right polemics. And basically, they went on to talk about how basically Saran was a left-wing a pawn of something called the Illuminati, but anyway, a communist, and that he had supposedly killed Kennedy as part of a communist conspiracy. Again, the same sort of painting of the Patsy Red that we saw with Oswald. Okay, now, interestingly enough, later on in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, we see this interesting number here by an interesting connection here, rather, of Edgar Eugene Bradley to Jerry Owen. Okay, now keep in mind also the American United organization that was painting Saran red, because American United, Edgar Eugene Bradley, Jerry Owen, and another right-wing evangelist named Bob Wells appear to have some connection. Certainly they move in the right circles, and there are some common addresses basically shared by all of them. In a footnote in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, Turner and Christian write as follows. Foundation researcher Walter J. Carithers informed us in 1971 that American United, keep in mind that's Hilder and Steinbacher's organization, once used the address P.O. Box 285, Woodland Hills, California, on some of its Illuminati record albums. This is the same address on the letterhead of the Edgar Eugene Bradley Defense Fund, an ad hoc group of right-wing preachers raising money to defend him against the charges levied by D.A. Jim Garrison in the JFK assassination case. One of the signatories of a fundraising letter sent out in July of 1968 was Orange County evangelist Dr. Bob Wells. In his 1968 interview with Jerry Owen, Turner asked if the preacher knew Wells. Very well. He don't live far from me. Know him well. Unquote. Did Owen know of the Bradley-Wells tie-in? I think Bradley was to speak for him once, unquote. So, Owen ties into Bradley, Bradley ties into Wells, Wells ties into Bradley, and Bradley ties into Edgar, the American United address. Keep in mind all of these connecting links, these evidentiary tributaries, and again, the attempt to paint Saran red.
Okay, going on and reading basically without prelude or prologue, a little bit more from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, it says, at 7:15 on the evening after the RFK shooting, a compact man with goggle eyeglasses marched into LAPD headquarters with four companions. He gave his name as Major Jose Antonio Duarte and said he and his men were, quote, freedom fighters against Fidel Castro. A Cuban exile, Duarte reported that on May 21st he had attended a leftist meeting because he knew that support for Castro was on the agenda. When he rose to speak out, he said, a small, olive-skinned young man angrily accused him of being a CIA agent, and they got into a shoving match. The young man was Sirhan Sirhan. Duarte tried to unload his story on the news media, but it was ignored. Then, on June 11th, the Anaheim Bulletin headlined, quote, pro-Castro link to RFK slaying. The article, written by Duarte's political associate John Steinbacher of the same Hilder and Steinbacher America United, recounted the Cuban's putative encounter with Sirhan. Steinbacher arranged radio appearances for Duarte, and in an instant paperback book entitled Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, The Man, The Mysticism, The Murder, summed up, quote, Mayor Sam Yorty of Los Angeles has already brought out the pro-communist inclinations of Sirhan, but it was left to Major Jose Duarte, the Cuban anti-communist, to link Sirhan with the riots and unrest in our nation today. In time, the LAPD discredited Duarte's identification of Sirhan by producing a look-alike Iranian student who had been at the leftist meeting and recalled being involved in the altercation. However, the entire scenario struck us, meaning the authors, as all too familiar. In August 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald was accosted by an anti-Castro exile while handing out pro-Castro literature on the streets of New Orleans. Shortly after the scuffle, Oswald was invited to participate in a radio debate on the subject. And you heard that, by the way, on the first episode here of Guns of November. We played that actual radio interview, radio debate. In the evening of the day John Kennedy was shot, taped excerpts were broadcast nationally, and Oswald was heard by millions proclaiming, I am a Marxist. Both the debate and the assassination evening airing of the excerpts were arranged by Edward S. Butler. who headed a right-wing propaganda outfit in New Orleans called the Information Council of the Americas. Well, by 1968, Butler had moved to Los Angeles, where he carried on with financial aid from Patrick J. Frawley, Jr., chief executive officer of the Schick Safety Razor Company. For years, Frawley generously supported hardline conservatives such as Ronald Reagan, Barry Goldwater, and Sam Yorty. Frawley and Yorty belonged to the American Security Council, an embodiment of the military-industrial complex that lobbied for a bigger military establishment and ran a political blacklist service for its large corporation clients. Anthony Hilder also claimed to have the backing of Frawley, and Butler was present when Steinbacher and Hilder held their unattended press conference. Okay, that's the same Ed Butler who was involved with the interview that we played here on the air of Lee Harvey Oswald being led to proclaiming his Marxism on radio, and which was heard the night of the assassination. Ed Butler was also tied up and was at Hilder and Steinbacher's press conference. Continuing, the authors say, thus a right-wing clique colored the facts and conjured up visions of a sinister occult cabal to depict Sirhan as the pawn of an international plot. As the Anaheim Bulletin rhetorically asked in an editorial, quote, are foreign influences at work to conquer this country? Is a hidden plot progressing to eliminate the liberal leadership of the country and throw the movement completely into control of communist agents?
Now, the shooting of George Wallace, if you have any questions about it, ask us a little later, or stay tuned to the subsequent programming here on the station, because we'll talk about it at some length, okay? Again, this supposedly was the work of Arthur Bremer, a lone nut, no connections to anybody, and it removed George Wallace from the presidential campaign. Now, George Wallace, of course, was a right-winger himself, very much opposed to desegregation. That's how he made his political name. And he was going for the Democratic nomination in 1972. He did not get the Democratic nomination and had no chance of doing so. He had announced his intention to run as a third-party candidate. Now, when he was shot and critically wounded by Arthur Bremer, what that basically did was to remove the possibility of him running as a third-party candidate. And in so doing, that guaranteed the at least operational sanctity of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. And if Wallace, in other words, had followed through with his intent to run as a third-party candidate, it might have jeopardized Nixon's strategy to carry the country by carrying all of the South, okay? When Sirhan shot George Wallace, that removed George Wallace as an independent party candidate, okay? Now, keep in mind Jerry Owen, and keep in mind that supposedly there's just a bunch of lone nuts with no connection among each other. Now, as it turns out, Jerry Owen, remember, he's a right-wing TV evangelist. One of his followers is a woman named Gail Aiken, last name A-I-K-E-N. Now, Gail Aiken was Arthur Bremer's sister, and here we have him hooked up with Jerry Owen. Again, reading from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. We discovered that Gail Aiken had known Owen for some time and undoubtedly accompanied him to the store. She had been a secretary to his college instructor brother since 1966 and was one of his most devoted religious followers. Immediately following the Wallace shooting, Owen somehow felt compelled to report his association with Aiken in an innocent context, just as he had with Sirhan, and again, he didn't go to the news media. However, instead of going to the police this time, he phoned newsman Baxter Ward's campaign headquarters. Ward was then running for his supervisorial post and excitedly insisted upon meeting the candidate. An appointment was set for the next day, but Owen failed to show up. Finally, Owen did show up at Ward's office. After first insisting to Ward that he hadn't called right after the Wallace shooting, he leaned forward sheepishly and in a low voice confided, "Do you realize that the girl who worked for my brother at Trade Tech College was the sister of the fellow who shot Wallace?" "No," Ward gasped. "And she just came to me and I helped her get an airplane ticket to go to Florida. They've been driving her crazy, poor little thing. She was my brother's secretary at Trade Tech for 8 years. The police and FBI had hounded her," Owen said, "and she came to him as a minister, unquote, for help. But he quickly revealed that there was more to it when he mentioned her promised return from her home in Miami to testify at his trial against KCOP and Orbox." "Unbelievable," Ward had commented when he informed Christian about Owen's disclosure. "Owen showing up in the background of the Wallace shooting is just too much to ask of coincidence." And apparently the... As it turns out, Gail Aiken was going to be a key witness on behalf of Jerry Owen in his trial against KCOP, but was whisked out of town that same night. So again, a hard link between the Robert Kennedy assassination and the shooting of George Wallace.
That again was from The Guns of November, Part 4, recorded on November 22, 1983, almost a quarter of a century ago. Again, in addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. That excerpt from The Guns of November, Part 4, shed some light on some of the many evidentiary tributaries running between our various political assassinations and attempted assassinations. Suffice it to say that there's a whole lot more going on than we have been told, or about which, than we have been told about, forgive me for ending a sentence with a preposition. By the way, also, in AFA program number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King, there's discussion of an operation that was run out of the Magellan Art Gallery, and this references the affidavit of Robert Byron Watson. That also has some discussion of the people who dispatched Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King talking about shooting George Wallace because he couldn't be controlled. So it's against the background of these many evidentiary tributaries running between our assassinations and attempted assassinations that we can properly evaluate the official very, very inadequate version. Once again, I'm going to read from the article, Arthur Bremer is Alone. The man who shot George Wallace is now out of prison, but questions about his stability remain. It's by Catherine Skip and Arian Campo Flores of Newsweek from November 10th of 2007. And the title, Arthur Bremer is Alone, has an unintended irony because actually he was not, in all probability, alone. In all probability, he wasn't even the person who shot George Wallace. But that shooting did eliminate George Wallace from the 72 campaign. So let's reflect on the official version here. In the frigid hours before dawn last Friday, Arthur Bremer emerged from the Maryland Correctional Institution in Hagerstown. He looked far different from the man who entered in 1972 for shooting Alabama Governor George Wallace, leaving him paralyzed from the waist down. Gone with a blonde head of hair and eerily cemented smile, now 57, Bremer is balding and paunchy with a long gray beard. Sporting civilian clothes and bearing three boxes of belongings, he exited through the prison's rear delivery gate and was whisked away in a convoy of six dark vehicles carrying state and federal law enforcement officers. His destination was unknown, his prospects uncertain. Arthur Bremer is alone, says a Maryland corrections spokesman. He has no one, unquote. I wonder what happened to Gail Aiken, by the way. I wonder what happened to his brother, too, who had Ellis Rubin for an attorney, the same attorney who represented the Watergate burglars. Continuing with the article, Bremer's release raises unique concerns. Forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz says no assassin has ever been freed from custody in the United States. Bremer failed in his attempt, but only narrowly. Back then, he was solitary and misanthropic, brimming with anger and craving notoriety. In prison, he withdrew, behaving well enough to shave 17 years off his 53-year sentence. Now that he's been released, he'll remain under state supervision until 2025 and will be barred from attending political events. The Secret Service will likely be watching him as well. Quote, he wants to have a low profile and be alone and be left alone, unquote, says David Bloomberg, chairman of the Maryland Parole Commission. Whether Bremer retains any homicidal tendencies 35 years after his crime remains a mystery, especially since he refused any mental health evaluation or treatment during his confinement. Quote, I don't believe he will be a danger, unquote, says Bloomberg, again quoting, but he will have to acclimate to making decisions that he hasn't had to make since 1972, unquote. Bloomberg describes Bremer as compliant and unobtrusive. Bremer never caused problems and devoted himself to a quiet clerical job in the prison library, a coveted senior position that he worked hard to attain. That offered him his only real opportunity for socializing, and he became, quote, the go-to man for help with reading, writing, or comprehending, unquote, says Bloomberg. Though Bremer's parents visited him for many years, both are now deceased. He's estranged from all four of his siblings except the youngest, Roger, with whom he reconnected in the past year, says Bloomberg. Nevertheless, he says, Roger declined to allow his brother to stay with him upon release. Roger did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Despite Bremer's docility, he has never expressed remorse for trying to kill Wallace, whose views on race apparently rankled him. In a 1997 written appeal after he was denied parole, he disparaged the governor as, quote, a segregationist dinosaur, unquote. Can we get the Confederate flag off your Maryland license plate and be halfway fair to Arthur H. Bremer, unquote, he wrote to the parole commission. A special license plate at the time featured the flag. I got a Bama lynching at my parole hearing and the chairman is whistling Dixie, unquote. That unrepentant attitude disturbs the Wallace family. Though the governor, who died in 1998, eventually forgave his assailant and wrote several letters to him over the years, to which Bremer never responded, other family members weren't as magnanimous. Quote, I just don't know if justice has been served when I consider how much my father suffered, unquote, said George Wallace III, 56. He, too, reached out to Bremer in the early 1990s and suggested a meeting. Bremer's response, according to the account Wallace's son says two FBI agents gave him, he jumped up on the bars of his cell and started making sounds like a monkey, unquote. While he has complied with the laws of Maryland, says Wallace, is he as stable as you would want, unquote? One wonders, too, about the fact that William Joseph Bryan, who is suspected by many of having been one of Saran's hypno-programmers, and who got a call from Laurel, Maryland, right after the shooting of George Wallace, that call in connection with the shooting, one wonders if Arthur Bremer may have been placed under mind control, too. Obviously, that's what I call food for thought or grounds for further research. But the fact that he started making sounds like a monkey and climbed up on the bars of his cell, Saran allegedly did similar things as well when questioned about key aspects of the crime which he supposedly committed. Continuing with this article, the official version, that is a legitimate worry, says Dietz, in the absence of treatment and where the original problem is one of personality, which is what the testimony was in the Bremer case, one does not expect for there to be improvement, he says. However, he adds, research shows that as violent offenders age, the likelihood of recidivism declines. What's almost certain is that Bremer will have a difficult time reintegrating himself to society. People who have been locked up for decades, says Dietz, often, quote, turn to their old social mechanisms of coping, social withdrawal, isolating themselves, figuring out whom to blame, building their anger, and repeating criminal acts. Well, that's the official version. You've also heard an alternative take, so to speak, on the shooting of George Wallace. Not many people remember who Arthur Bremer was, but in all probability, there's much more to his story than we have been told. The hidden history of American political science and of the history of much of the rest of the world, the area of fascism and the Second World War in particular, is available on the Spitfire website. There is a brand new Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. New site, same fight. So please use the brand new Spitfire website. The information is there. We're still transferring some files, so if you don't see everything you want, it'll be there soon. Most of it's already there and in a much more usable and user-friendly and professional-looking form. Again, new site, same fight, so please use the new Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the link websites to WFMU and to others. And those of you who have your own websites, please be encouraged to link to the Spitfire website as well. I state without qualification that it is the best individual resource on this subject material available. It is without equal. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Dave Emery, and this concludes Side 2, For the Record program number 648, Arthur Who, being recorded on September 7th of the year 2008. Happy election year.